Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 461. My name is Minter Dial, and I'm your host for this podcast, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. For more information, or to check out other shows on the Evergreen Network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. So this week's interview is with John Jeffcock. John is founder and CEO of Winmark, an edtech business that includes 16 C-suite networks with 700 multinationals across 18 countries. He's also a decorated former captain in the British Army. In this conversation with John, we discuss his recently published book, The Sweet Spot: Reaching, Leading, and Delivering the C-Suite. We discuss his work at Winmark, how being an officer in the Army informed his leadership style, what defines success for him, the profound importance of governance, ethical frameworks, purpose, and much more. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. Please do consider to drop in your rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. Now for the show with John. John Jeffcock, welcome to the Minter Dialogue. You are the CEO and founder of the C-suite network business, Winmark, which you started in 1997. And you described it as an ed tech. We're going to get into that. You're also, and importantly, as far as I'm concerned, a former captain in the British Army, decorated for distinguished service in the First Gulf War. Thank you for your service. And also for managing the Northern Cordon around Sarajevo, for the UN during the war in Bosnia. That touched me a lot. So I'd like to start off, John, just by asking you, how much did your experience in the British Army help you to form you, to instruct your leadership style?
Okay, that's a good question. A couple of ways. I think in the Army stuff has to work, if that makes sense. And so as a result, I have a very practical approach, and I want to understand how things work, and I want to do things in an open, honest way. And I also think that one of the things you have in the military is everyone has to be able to do everyone else's job, and so you train to a high standard. And then let them free on the ground. So I think that very much plays in. I think also in the military you have to have extraordinary tenacity. And if you're a founder, you go through tough times. You know, I've remortgaged the house twice. You know, I put the payroll on my credit card once, but a long time ago. And so I think if I hadn't sort of had that level of resilience, I may have given up a long time ago, which would have been a mistake. So I'd say a combination of tenacity, practical approach, and also probably just straightforward planning. I remember when I did my MBA, I found quite a few things quite hard, because I found things like performance related pay really hard to understand, because I thought, why weren't they doing that in the first place? Why do you have to give them commission for them to work hard? I couldn't understand that as a concept. And so I find parts of it very hard, but when it came down to planning, I think I scored the highest mark ever scored on the course, but purely because that's all I've done for the last 7 years of my life was endless small plans on operations. So probably planning, tenacity, yeah.
And so the basic premise of capturing is that, well, if you say it, you do it.
Yeah. Life's too short. Yes.
Right, but I've written a book on the Second World War and had an enormous amount of interactions with people in the military. And the thing that I always get out of it, which is that in wartime in the military, the single most important thing to protect is your line of communication. And so it seems, in the British Army, I'd love to know if that's also the case, but the attention to communications is so vital in the Army in order to get things done. And I feel it somewhat similar in the issue of business. If your communication lines aren't clear and the messages that are within aren't clear, things go wobbly.
Yeah, I think that's entirely true. And I think also within that, a key point is the it's a purpose of it's a purpose of the communication. So what is the ultimate task here? And you know, what are we trying to achieve? Because I think a lot of people in business get lost in rubbish. You know, they get lost in sort of detail that's just not relevant to what you're fundamentally trying to achieve. And I think that it sounds like a weird thing to say, but I think in poetry you have to cut to the chase. In a sense, you can't have spare words. And I think in the same way that in business it's useful you just cut to the chase. You know, this is fundamentally what we're trying to do. That's a nice thing to do, but is it going to progress us in any way on the journey? And so you know, I take my I take my children up a mountain in Austria. My wife is Austrian, so and part of getting a mobile phone, they had to climb this mountain. Part of all the criteria they had to meet, and within that, the day before they packed their rucksack. And I had to sort of unpack the whole thing, lie it out on the table, pull out the Barbie dolls. That's all the rubbish to take with you because it's just not needed on the journey. So I think there is a point on the communication that it's keeping people focused on what you're fundamentally trying to achieve and repeating it and making sure they're clear about the task at hand. Yes. Yeah. So I would entirely support that.
Well, now that you mentioned poetry, I understand, John, you've written some poetry. Is that accurate? Tell us about that, if that's the case, and why you do it.
So I did two books. I did one that I wrote and one that I did with the Ministry of Defence and the Poet Laureate, which was a combination of poems from people who were serving, which was actually, I think, the first book because serving soldiers aren't by law allowed to write. And so I got special permission from the Ministry of Defence to do that. And it was really interesting. Actually, this really, really interesting happened because I got General Dannett and the Poet Laureate to mark all the poets, if that makes sense, you know, just to say how good they were, and they had to rank out 10. And then they came back to me and I would put it into a sort of scoring sheet and then make choices on which poems went in. And what was really interesting about it was the Poet Laureate was, her focus was very much on the quality of the literature, whereas the General Dannett's view was very much focused on the integrity of the experience, in that sense. And the two did not meet. And so I went with General Dannett. I think slightly upset.
Cut to the chase.
Because you know, no one's interested in someone saying that the barbed wire is the writing of generals on battlefield. Who cares? They're interested in the injury and someone trying to keep the bandage on and how they're doing it and the sweat. It's making it impossible for it to sort of stick on, if that makes sense. And so it's the intensity of the experience you need to get across. And for me, the purpose of the book, and this gets back to the same point, the purpose of the book was I wanted soldiers to be able to hand it to their partner or their children and say, this is what it's like. This is the real thing. Yeah. And so some of the poems weren't very good. They were written by people like Gurkhas, and it was second language. They were written by 7-year-old children saying, "Why, Dad, are you going to war?" kind of thing. But it was a very moving book, and there was a couple of poems I couldn't put in because they were a bit too brutal. But
too much pathos, or too much the language was too brutal.
No, we had in the group of poets I had one guy who was So I would describe myself as a proper soldier. I went away quite a lot. There was one guy who wrote for the book who made me look like a Boy Scout. And so it's a proper Special Forces, and went on for Special Forces to do other things for the state. And he did things and experienced things, which I think that middle-class UK is not up for knowing. And the level of what people actually do in these environments is not because they can't experience it, but I think it doesn't help them in any way. It would just upset them.
Well, I can't but help, as I'm listening to you, this poem is running through my mind, so I feel like I just need to start it and maybe you can finish it. If I should die, think only this of me, that there shall be a corner of a foreign field that shall be forever England's.
Yeah, so I've enjoyed my, let's say, wartime poetry in my life and explored that. So thanks for sharing those thoughts. John, we're going to get into your book, but I wanted to talk a little bit about your Winmark business, your role as a CEO. And I want to start with the question, how do you define success?
Oh, okay. I think a couple of ways. I think so we define success by the impact you have. So for us, it's really about, did we achieve something for these people, and was it real, and was it mature? And I think if you get that bit right, the money comes. That makes sense. So I think that the money. I think my finance directors always thought we were a bit of a charity. I got trouble. The advantage of making money though in a company, which is really important, is it gives you confidence to do stuff. So if you make money as a company, you're able to invest in stuff. You're able to experiment more. You're able to do all those great things. And I was talking to someone the other day who had a bad year, and he's sort of retrenched into himself because he's now got to look at cost reduction. He's now got to look at so you start to go from opportunity to cost. So I think made the making money is an important part of it. For me, I want to build a battleship. That makes sense. I'm not interested in building a buy sell person. That makes sense. I'm interested in building something that is useful, that works, and is around for years to come. It doesn't really matter whether I run it or not. I want to build it. So from that perspective, I guess I'm a builder rather than an entrepreneur. Does that make sense?
So HMS Winmark, tell us about the battleship that you've been building, Winmark, and what is your role as a CEO entail in this ed tech business that you've started?
Okay, so we've been around for about 24 years, and what we basically do is run these C-suite networks. And the idea is very simple. Is if you get made a national, regional, global lead, where do you learn from? And the choice is typically academia, consultancy, or your peers is where you learn from. The academic environment tends to run out at about 35, that makes sense. So if you go to even the best business schools in the world, and you get taught finance, you get taught, you know, cash flow and all these things, but you're not taught how to be a CFO. So where do you learn how to do that? And then you've got your great consultancies and Bain's, the McKinsey's of the world, who do a great job. But if you achieve your CFO, you'd much rather listen to another CFO on how they do stuff. So I was talking to a FTSE 100 CEO yesterday. He's going to talk to our CEO network. And he was talking about the people engine he's created behind that. And that's why they've been successful. They've grown by 600% in the last, I can't remember what the time frame was, but they've grown enormously in a short period of time. And he said it was all about getting the people bit right. And, you know, why do they wake up in the morning? What do they get out of that? So that was the main driver of that. So the idea is that to pull these people to get together to share how to do stuff. So it's not theory. It's not, it's practice examples of how to do stuff. And with that, we try and get content off them and all sorts of stuff. And it works really well. We also feed in, I think it's quite interesting, the top level consultancies, we like what we do. So the McKinsey World and Bain & Co. like what we do, because in a way we make their buyers better. If that makes sense. Mm. Whereas if you're a consultant, you've got quite a shallow depth of knowledge, you hate us because we'll just introduce an HR director, another HR director who's just done it, and there's no need to meet you. So from one perspective, we're very well liked. Another perspective, we're not very liked because we can eliminate the need for a consultancy. From that perspective,
you raise the playing field.
Yeah, yeah. And what have we? So we were running all these face-to-face meetings. We were running about 200 a year face-to-face, with about 20 people, and someone signing up and saying, "This is what I've done," and then you ask a lot of questions. So and when COVID hit, we had to obviously stop that. But overnight. And we flipped to not Zoom, went somewhere else, and then everyone ended up going to Zoom. ZNS had flipped to Zoom after that. It was slightly dull. We got our first bet was wrong. So we went to Zoom. And the cool thing about that was you could suddenly expand globally. So actually, you could have we had a fantastic session where we had Inmarsat in the UK talking. We had Volvo Financial Services, which is based in Delaware in the US. And it was all being chaired by a guy in Barclays who's based in Kenya. And so you can run these global events, which is quite exciting. And that brings in, I think, a kind of a new dynamics of the world. So, we were looking at the best people in the UK. We can now get the best people in the world to talk, to share, which is really good. The other good thing about it is it's the cultural different, the different cultures, different approaches to stuff. And actually, you might go, actually, well, the Asians do this quite well. I was talking to a guy in Singapore last week who was saying, actually, we really like this because the way Europe approaches tech transformation is different to Asia. The phases they go through are slightly different, and actually, it's really interesting to just it makes you reflect on your own processes. So take that perspective. It's really interesting. Yeah,
that's something that I suppose is typically done internally when you have the, let's say, they get the general manager of the United States who moves to become the general manager of China, and then can sort of swing some of the processes that he or she learned in the United States to China or vice versa. And as the executives move around the business, they sort of seed and bring their processes and their different cultural biases and understandings into the thing. That's fascinating. So tell us about a little bit about the size of Windmark and how many people are members and who are the types of people you want to have join.
Okay, so we're not sort of Fortune or FTSE snobs, if that makes sense. So we work with organizations who employ 1,000 people plus. You need a certain level of complexity to make us worthwhile, if that makes sense. So do that. We have a whole group of companies people have never heard of, but are colossal in size. Colossal. I speak, our last chief information officer was a company called Motor Oil. They're headquartered in Athens. I have to say, forgive me, I've never heard of them, but they have the largest refinery in Southern Europe. They have a retail chain of hundreds of shops. They have a bank that and they're family owned. So they're not on the list. And it's quite interesting. I think in the UK, a lot of the largest companies are public companies. Where you go to Southern Europe, a lot of them are family owned. You know, I think it's really interesting in Germany, Siemens is a family, BMW is a family. You know, they're all family businesses, which goes back to the point that you made in your book about those key important things. So I think there is a, so it's quite interesting how big. So we have a complete spectrum of members from Disney and HSBC to organizations you would never heard of. But it's fun. They're all intelligent people trying to do the right thing. And I know that business sometimes in the news gets this sort of barotation. They're all based on greed. But most people I know are good, normal people, very bright, very intelligent beings, trying to do the right thing for their organizations.
At the very outset, John, you were talking about how things don't get done or communications fail and things get in the way. The little thought, the three-letter word that I was thinking of is ego. The other thing which probably is related to ego, which I would hear about a lot is, well, not invented here syndrome, and the types of challenges of incorporating best practices from somewhere else or ideas done elsewhere as well. That couldn't be done here. Or, well, you're a publicly traded company. It's very different for me. I can do this because I'm privately owned. Or vice versa. And those types of barriers to openness, to exchange and learn from others, is that something that you run across? And how does one deflect that or get through it?
So that's quite an interesting point. If I sounds like a weird response for that, but I think you were mentioning earlier about the Second World War and how you've done some writing in that space. One of the things you find in war is peacetime soldiers don't very often make the best wartime soldiers, and actually it's school teachers who take over and who become the officers and win the battles, kind of thing in the end. And I think that COVID's had the same impact. I think COVID's been quite a big clean out because you've had to innovate extraordinarily quickly. We had the senior partner of McKinsey's Bay Area in San Francisco come talk to our members, and said one of the things that I thought that she said two really cool things which were really interesting. The first thing that was that CEOs should have a to-be list as well as a to-do list. So who am I going to be in this meeting? Am I the top negotiator? Am I the motivator? What am I getting? Which also one of the things we've learned from COVID is that we can make big moves fast, really big moves really fast. And so we had to give you sort of a working example of that. We had the chief procurement officer of Sainsbury's, which I think his budget is 4 billion a year, kind of thing. So massive budget. And they own Argos. and they had to shut Argos down completely, but they shifted the entire Argos staff across to Sainsbury's, because Sainsbury's needed stewards and to let people into the shop and to manage the during COVID. They did that over a weekend.
Wow.
So 40 hours later, they shifted an entire company staff into entirely new roles, entirely different sites over a weekend. And I think people learned at the COVID that they can move really, really fast. They also learned that not everyone's good at that. And I think there was a big, something we saw in the private equity organizations that quite a lot of CEOs got moved on. So there was a bit of a cleaning out. So I think you're right, there is that innovation communication bit. Mm-hmm. I think there has been a change on that. I think the diversity bit coming through is a really important part of that, because the diversity does lead to innovation, because you get different mindsets approaching things in a different way. It's quite interesting if you look at the sort of psychology theory, you know, men, for example, tend to take, if the pressure increases, they tend to take more risk, whereas women tend to do the opposite. I mean, obviously that's a huge generalization, but therefore having that balance in a boardroom or exec team is really important. And so therefore you get a different approach. So I think that it is getting better is my positive hope for the world.
That's great. Well, I mean, certainly being able to talk with people who are operating in different parts of the world, doing different things in different industries, as long as you have the mindset that's curious and you can get rid of the ego in the listening, then you have great opportunities. And same goes for diverse mind, you know, diverse perspectives, whether that's visible or not. Being able to have diversity of opinion in the boardroom is so vital. So let's now talk about your book. I thought your book, John, was really a masterpiece in that it made me stop, think, write, underline, cogitate just endlessly, because it really is very rich. So it's called the Sweet Spot, Reaching, Leading, and Delivering the C-Suite. So first question, it's just a setup. Your O in spot is red. Why is that?
I guess that for us is a suite in itself. In Hamilton, they talk about you have to be in the room where it happens. And for me, the O is in a way the boardroom table. It's a room where it happens. So the whole book is about getting people into the room where it happens. I guess
that's fun, because I thought it was going to be the officer. The CEO, you do break down the chief, the executive, and the officer element, and perhaps at some level those are the same things. But anyway, that was what I read into it.
Okay, the great thing about these things is they can read in different ways. I remember when we first formed Winmark, so someone said, in our marketing director group network, does that stand for winning marketing? And I went, yes, of course it does. I've never heard of that before. So I'm very happy for people to interpret that however they want, as long as it's good.
Exactly. Well, you know, I like to see the symbols, and that's one of the things that I like to try to bring to leadership, is to open yourself to the signals and symbols that are out there.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I want to tell you about my podcast called Can I Offer You Some Feedback? I'm a business consultant and executive coach with over 20 years experience in change management, leadership development, and naturally providing feedback to high performers. My podcast is for those of you who have a complicated relationship with feedback, whether giving, receiving, avoiding, or seeking. Feedback is essential for our development. In each episode, you'll hear from real people across industries with their ideas, perspectives, and best practices on feedback. I'll also be sharing business bites with you, simple explanations of organizational tools, management techniques, and leadership philosophies that will help you and your businesses thrive. You can listen to Can I Offer You Some Feedback on your favorite podcast app, or learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com.
You talk about making the C, you talk about a lot of things, but things I wanted to pick up on. You talk about making the C-suite more aware of the customer and how often that's lost in the place where things are happening in the C-suite. And you mentioned the Standard Chartered Customer Week. Talk us through how important it is and what can boards and C-suites do to re-inject the customer into that conversation.
I think it's a very simple answer to that. I think the answer is talk to them. And I think that sounds like a very the thing, but I always remember we had Justin King come and talk to our CEO network, and he turned around and said, "I don't get this lonely CEO thing." He said, "I've got, you know, 30,000 employees who all love me. How can I possibly be lonely? If I'm lonely, there must be something wrong with me." And there is the customer thing is quite simple. Go and talk to them. And I think it's also really important that the top echelon don't stop doing that. They always need to put a meeting on the diary every week. I'm going to talk to a customer, go on the shop floor, ask them the question. I think also people get not used to it, that makes sense. They get not used to it, and then they become a bit shy towards it. And actually they need to get out there. We had a really good example of this in one of our networks, a CEO group, where it was a £100 million business, something went wrong with an account. And the CFO or the client side turned around and said, "Actually, do you know what? Let's use someone else." And the CEO thought, "Oh, I need to engage here," and went to write out the CFO and said, "Can I talk to you?" And the CFO said, "You know, if you cared, you'd have called me 6 months ago. You clearly don't. We're moving supplier." And it was a big account. And the CEO sat back and just thought, put his sort of hands in his head, said, "I don't know any of our core customers. I just don't know them. And if I have to intervene, I have no traction on them." And it's really interesting. So the first thing he did was his response to that was to create a COO, because I need to get out there and talk to a customer all the time. So I think it's really important you don't lose connectivity. It also makes you more valuable. You know, all these incoming CEOs, the first thing they do when they arrive, they go and talk to customers. So it's really hard to compete with that in these top levels. You know, if you're in a room and someone says, "I think we should do this," and then someone says, "Well, I think we should do this," and then the other person goes, "Oh, well, when was the last time you spoke to a customer?" It sort of kills you on the spot. I think it's really important that you think, in a way, it keeps you real. It's a bit like the front line. You've got a soldier type on the front line. In the hospitals, you need to be one of the nurses, you know, in the casualty wards, so you understand what's really going on. I think likewise, the top team has to be on the front line and talking with customers and being with their sales teams, I think, you know, regularly.
Really. I so agree with that, John. I worked at L'Oréal for 16 years, and there was always this idea of going on the road and sur la route, as we say in French. But it was such a manicured version of it, where the sales teams knew that the senior executives were going to be speaking to their clients, so they prepped their clients. And so the challenge is finding that authentic relationship, because you can also have the case where, you know, you're coming to the CEO, and in this case, we're talking about hairdressers. And so you're a small hairdresser in some small town, and the CEO of a $50 billion company comes to you. You can also feel pressured and not feel quite as at ease with a CEO who comes with 10 other people to crowd into your small hairdressing salon to try to meet the customer. And so you do need to be smart about it as well, in the sense that you want to create an authentic dialogue and find out really what's happening. Yeah. And don't impose your title on them, for example. Second of all, the opportunity to do it regularly. So you need to carve out time for it. The way I used to sort of get around that at some level was I used to bring our customer service people into our C-suite. So once I had the head of customer service part of my C-suite, which I thought was the person who then had, in her case, a woman in her seat, she was representing the customers ipso facto. And usually the customer service group is some sort of sub wing of some other department, oftentimes offsite, if not outsourced. And so this whole relationship with the customer for me was so important. And how do you sensitize the CFO, the operations manager who's worried about how many units are going down the factory line, when this, you know, it all ends up in the customer's hands, but that seems so far away from my preoccupation because I don't have enough people on my staff. My efficiencies aren't where they need to be. And we get fog bombed by all these other things, and the poor old customer oftentimes gets pushed aside.
Exactly. So I could agree with that more.
So I want to talk about governance. It is obviously a really important part for you, and I also think it is for me. And as you say, it's not exactly the sexiest part of the whole story, but I absolutely appreciated how much importance you gave to it. So for you, John, why and how has governance changed over the last decade? You who've been running your business for 20 odd years, it seems like it's changed. And the word that I want to inject into that is this notion of transparency.
Yes, I think that okay. So I think the governance is really, really important. And I think as you grow up and take more responsibility, in a way, you realize more and more how important it is, because those small decisions made at that level trickle down into much, much bigger things. And so it's a bit like a compass. If you steer it slightly off, if that makes sense, the you can end up in a very different place. So I think it's very important that the governance is right. And the way to learn governance is to experience it. I think it's a bit like little people in sports, they talk about muscle memory. So it's a similar thing to that. You need to experience it. It's cool. I think it has changed dramatically. In a good way. I think it used to be much more closed doors. It used to be there was a lack of diversity of thought in many places. I also think it varied from where you were. There was, in a way, a lack of innovation. People got consumed by it, if that makes sense. And I think there's been quite an interesting thing that's gone on now, because in reality, the role of the executive committee is to set the strategy and then execute it and make it happen. And the role of governance is to make sure that is happening within a sort of an agreed framework, if that makes sense. You referred to egos earlier, you get the egos of individuals who actually comes about them, more about the thing. And I always worry when we see members on the speaker circuit a bit too much. Don't they have a day job? And you think they're at that conference and that conference and that conference. And you think, really? How does it work? And then you get people behind the scenes you've never heard of, but the company's doing really, really well. And you think, quite interesting. So I do think the ego bit comes into it, the government bit comes into it. I think being alert to things, having great antennae is really important. I've generally found in life that there are people who get stuff in a way that other people get stuff. So we have a group of 100 people, there are probably 5 people you can go up to, you can learn as much from those 5 people as you could from interviewing all 100, if that makes sense. So you want to find those brains and those wise heads, if that makes sense, if you can. And they won't always be wise forever, but acknowledge the fact, quite say. And take as much as you can, because there are sometimes where you just need to reflect. You might just not get stuff, if that makes sense. You might go, actually, do you know what? Is our thinking on this completely? I always found the really interesting one is the Barbie Bratz story, because you had the Barbie doll, and you must have think, I'd love to work in toy R&D. Wouldn't that be fun? A toy R&D on Barbie must be going. They never really changed it. Then Bratz rocks up and takes half the shelf space in a very short space of time, and it's devastating for them. But it's not hugely innovative. It's about the same size. It's a bit more diverse. Barbie could have easily done that, but they just didn't. They weren't able to make that gentle move, and that in a way is why you need to bring customer into governance to keep it focused on stuff. And you've got to stop being drowned by regulation, making sure you spend the time thinking about right things. I think you'd be very disciplined in running those meetings.
Yeah, well, there's in the regulation side, there can be a lot of process and people needing to follow the regulatory needs and the rules with regard that govern the way a board should be done. I have two areas that I think it would be interesting to explore. One is the ethics framework. You talked about framework just before. How do you see the ethical line being drawn up in boards and C-suites these days?
So some people think the role of the general counsel, chief legal officer, is in a way the chief ethics officer. I don't agree with that. I think the CEO is the chief ethics officer. We had a lovely example of this, which illustrates it very well, is we had Airbnb. We had the general counsel of Airbnb was made the chief ethics officer, which is I think one of the first people in the world to get the title kind of thing. And they had an issue on People had rooms, not giving us rooms to people of colour, which is a really bad, bad issue. And so the lawyer sits back and reflects upon this in terms of you know, what legal rights do we have over those homeowners? You know, what can we do? Can they do that? What legal rights has? And goes up to the CO, presents this is our legal position on this, and the CO goes, I don't care if they're saying that, we don't work with them. Full stop. End of story. I don't care if we lose half our homes. That is the ethical line we run, because the whole purpose of MB is to give people access to these people. And it's not about giving some people access to people. It's everybody. That's our purpose. And so we don't. So we just stop working with them. So I think that role needs to be owned by the CEO. I think it's really important that, again, this goes back. You don't get lost in the mud of ethics and regulation. Actually, what is the right thing to do? And I think people are held to account on that. I think sometimes they're held to account in a bit of a tough way. That makes sense. I think sometimes it can be unfair. I know a media company that recently went under because one of the founder was accused of something. Did it happen? No one knows, but the company's now got bust. It was a 30-year-old company, employed a couple hundred people. So I think you've got to be quite careful on it. But I do think the CEO has to own the ethics and set the standards. Sadly, our politicians don't do the same thing.
Mm-hmm. holding people accountable to those ethics and having that hard line, I think that really goes back to the sentence you made earlier, which is you have to experience governance. Because when you are in that moment where someone crosses the line and you're in the CEO and you're trying to get this other detail or item on the agenda covered, but you have to break. You have to know to break to address that issue. Hey, dude, that was not what we consider the right thing to do in our company. And you have to be able to tell that story then and there, which may not be a pleasant thing. It's not helping with your efficiencies and your effectiveness, but you need to know when to do that, when not to do it. And then if you don't do it on the moment, well, A, you're not addressing everybody, and B, you may forget to do it afterwards. So yeah, if those are things that are examples of living governance. Would you agree?
Yes, you need to call it out. If you're not happy, you need to call it out.
So
on the spot.
One of the things I really enjoyed in your very pragmatic approach, John, was along the question of what is my mission, my vision, my purpose, and my North Star? And you kind of, in a one fell swoop, say, just don't worry about which one you're going to actually focus on. Keep it simple and think about what is the key point. Tell us in your own words, if I'm right, how you think these types of very consultancy words should be dressed in your company.
Okay, so I think as an organization now you need a purpose more than a vision, because I also think as organizations become more remote with remote working and 3 days and 2 days a week, whatever you end up having, you need a stronger thing to pull people together and keep people focused. And so a purpose is in a way more powerful. It's a bit like a political party. You need this is what we're trying to do in the world. This is our, as Steve Jobs would say, this is going to be our dent in the universe. This is what we're fundamentally trying to do. I think if you then give them a vision and mission statements, they can't remember it gets too much. They need that line. They need that line. There was a very famous line with JFK, wasn't he, when he was walking around NASA and he meets someone who's clean the toilets and he says, what are you doing here, instead of trying to put the first man on the moon. He said, that's what you want. And that is a quick example. Consultants rock up to your office and the first thing they do is they ask your receptionist, what's your vision statement, and they need the line. And if you've got three of them, you just lose it. So you need that very concise, this is why we exist in the world. And Simon Sinek talks about that, doesn't he? He talks about it's why, how, what, his golden circle. And it's the why is really important. So I would focus on the why and get everyone focused on that and embed it through. I think you get the why and the values and you've kind of nailed it. The vision and your annual objectives all sort of feeds into that and delivers on that. And there's a way the administration that comes behind it. And I don't down administration. There was a great US general who talked about, which I really liked the comment, he said, good generals talk about strategy, great generals talk about admin. But I just, there's a lot to that. So once you've set your purpose and you set your thing, it's about corralling and administrating the whole organization to follow that route. And that's where the hard work comes in. That's where really hard work comes in.
It is. I mean, you need to be able to say it over and over again in order for it to actually seep into the entire company, because not everyone gets to hear you. And back to the communications line. And it makes me think also about the British Army and how in wartime, there does seem to be generally a clear purpose. You know, we got to beat them. And somehow that helps to unite. Of course, if you take the Second World War, how the different forces within one country's military would tend to want to have the bigger ego. And I'm talking about the Pacific, in particular between the Navy, the Army, and the Marines, and who's to do what. And we got the same enemy, but it's amazing how even in wartime, even in the military, we can forget the rallying idea, the rallying purpose, and let egos get in the way.
Yeah, sadly.
Indeed. So, John, it's been a pleasure to have you on my show and to talk about your book, The C-Suite, to talk about your company, Windmark. How can people grab your book? Also, I'd love to have people read your war poetry and get in touch with you, maybe even apply to become part of Windmark.
And I guess the best way to do it is to Google us or contact me on LinkedIn. Jeff Cock is quite an unusual surname, so there aren't many of us. So that's way to do it. I'm told people should buy the book through the publisher, which is Bloomsbury, which is a better way of doing it, I understand, but that's their call. I really hope the book helps people. The book is written to try and help. It's not about me trying to tell great stories. It's about really trying to do it, what practically help a career. So I really hope that helps people. And so go online and find me. I'm always happy to help. We always need new members, and particularly on the international as we build out this sort of global C-suite platform. So I guess that's about it. And thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure, on your show. John. Absolutely. I really recommend anybody who's in a leadership position who wants to be, I would say, provoked into understanding that they need to learn more to do a proper job on the C-suite, to check out The Sweet Spot with a Red O by John Jeffcock on Bloomsbury and other lovely e-tailers, I'm sure. Thanks again, John.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minter Dialogue podcast. If you like the show, would like to support me, please consider a donation on patreon.com/MinterDial. You can also subscribe on your favorite podcast service. And as ever, rating and reviews are the real currency for podcasts. You'll find the show notes with over 2,000 or more blog posts on MinterDial.com. Check out my documentary film and 4 books, including my last one, You Lead, How Being Yourself Makes You a Better Leader. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
A stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger. To feel free, trust is the reason. Still, I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hope for your respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man, to live and die submerged. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man, competition's innate. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. Despise revenges and struggle with deceit. challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, me to the test. I'm a convinced man.
I'm ready, fire and arrest.
I'm a convinced man in the arms of a woman.
Best known investor and Wall Street expert Warren Buffett once said, "Wall Street is the only place that people ride to in a Rolls Royce to get advice from those who take the subway." Mr. Buffett's quote is remarkably accurate, but how many people would rather receive advice from him than someone simply guessing? Welcome to Buy, Hold, Sell, your single source for Wall Street knowledge and profitable guidance. Please join me, Todd Schoenberger, and fellow trader Tobin Smith, as well as host Veronica Dudo, for a podcast known to move the needle for investors. Tobin and I are seasoned Wall Street executives with deep investment experience, and we are prepared to share our advice to those who choose to listen. Download Buy, Hold, Sell today on the Evergreen Podcast Network or your favorite podcast channel.